Hello.
And welcome
to Say Podcast and Die.
The podcast where two queers, or today three queers, sit in a closet and talk about goosebumps.
And about science.
Yeah, we have a special guest today. We should introduce everyone who's in this fine closet. I'm Andy. I use they, them pronouns.
I'm Alyssa. I use she, her pronouns.
And who are you?
Who are you? Why are you in here with us?
It's a great question. I'm Sam, and I also use she, her pronouns.
Sam, what do you do?
I am a fifth-year PhD candidate in chemical biology at Boston College.
And also the senior science correspondent to our show. Sam has already been behind the scenes helping us get things right about tomatoes and sharks.
Yeah, and sea labs.
Yes.
Yeah, so we've brought Sam on the pod today to talk about science and mad science and the very, very, very inexplicable science of the Gooseverse.
Or is it explicable?
That's what we're here to find out.
So. It's definitely science fiction. It's extremely interesting
science Spoiler fiction. Spoiler alert.
Strong emphasis on the fiction.
Thank you for being here, Sam.
You're very welcome.
All right. So what is it that you do?
Basically, I make genetically engineered viruses, and we are using them to create a variety of chemical tools.
Cool.
With viruses.
With viruses. And I have spent the majority of the pandemic screaming about how everyone is doing it wrong.
Cool.
To start off, I have a highly technical question. Science. What is? How do?
Okay, let's tackle those one at a time. Science. What is? So science is basically a way of approaching, investigating mostly the natural world. It's a very systematic series of steps in which you ask questions and then use a variety of different techniques to learn about nature, to learn about what's possible in nature, and sometimes to like progress our own technology. But the key thing about science is that we are using a very specialized like way of looking at the world and trying to be as quote unquote objective as possible. So the main goals like of the scientific process essentially is to take the human factor out of our investigations.
Because we suck.
Well, we do for a number of reasons, but also we are unreliable. Mm-hmm. So our sensory systems are limited and our ways of processing and looking at patterns are highly biased in terms of what was beneficial to us as we evolved. And so we might see patterns that aren't really there. And so we use a lot of scientific instruments and math, a lot of math, to figure out.
You look so apologetic when you say that. Like, I don't want to scare you, but a lot of math.
There's a lot of math. I mean, I don't know. I have two literature professors in the room with me, or in the closet. But there's a lot of math going into seeing if what we are looking at is really there. And then the other big aspect of science would be peer review, in which mostly old white men who think you're doing it wrong tell you why they would have designed the experiment differently.
Ooh, we have that in the humanities too.
Yeah, it's not the paper that you would have written, or that he would have written, so it's not very good.
Exactly. Until he forgets that he told you that and then decides it was his idea later.
Right, yeah. So, but then the how do aspect of your question, there's a lot of crying.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I can relate.
Yeah, so it's very important in science to find a crying location that is private because crying is not allowed in the lab at all. So I have some secret crying places in the chem building. I also have some public crying places when I don't mind if people see me cry. but there's a lot of failure in science, and so one of the very common jokes that you'll hear scientists make is there's a reason that we call it research. Because you have to repeat things over and over and over again, and that's why there's so much crying.
Ah.
That makes sense.
So you're like, I did the things I was supposed to, but my cells didn't grow type of thing?
Yeah, or they're not glowing the right color. or that DNA band is the wrong size. Or there's just nothing there.
What I've learned is my hypothesis was wrong, but I have learned it.
Or I did it wrong and I can't tell which is which. Hence the crying.
It sounds like itself could be the fodder for some good horror stories, like a Groundhog Day type of scenario.
Oh, my PhD thesis.
Yes.
Every day, over and over again.
I was thinking, as you were talking, how opposite fiction is from what you're describing, because you were saying we're talking about the natural world and we're trying to remove the human factor in coming up with patterns and explanatory mechanisms. And it's like the exact opposite in fiction, where you're like, okay, we're not looking at the natural world, we're looking at an imagined world, and we are centering the human perspective as a way of trying to interpret patterns and things.
Not necessarily.
Ah, go on, you're the writer.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, I think, personally, a lot of really good fiction is also about being consistent within those things, trying to observe things, describe them accurately, and in a way that is compelling, which is maybe less so the case in scientific research. Like, it doesn't matter if it's boring, right?
Not necessarily. So a huge part in getting a grant is showing that what you're going to do solves a problem of major societal concern. Mm-hmm. So your grant has to be sexy. So the things that we do in our lab are very much generating, like, primary research tools. Mm-hmm. Like, we're basically building a better wrench. And we have to demonstrate, or at least tell the NSF or the NIH, that our wrench is going to cure cancer. Mm-hmm. And
also why the old wrench sucks.
Yeah, the old wrench is
unsexy. Yeah,
is unsexy. You need a super sexy wrench with lights and, like, glitter, and it spins. And that's the wrench that's going to cure cancer, and that's why you should give me $1 million to make it.
You need a, like, Tim Jacobus design cover for your research proposal.
Oh, man. If only I could get that. We'd have so many grants.
What's something you wish more people knew about science?
There's so many things that I wish people knew about science. The first thing that I wish that people knew about science is that you cannot prove anything through science. You can prove something mathematically, but you can only find support for your hypothesis empirically. And so on all those TV commercials where companies are saying that this item has been clinically proven to do X, they are lying to you. That is false. Nothing has been clinically proven to do anything.
Are you suggesting that an advertisement is lying to me?
It is. Gasp.
And so, the medical industry? The big pharma?
What? I would love some of that big pharma money. Please give me big pharma money. And also, be truthful in your advertisements. I very much go out of my way to not purchase products when the advertisements say that it's clinically proven, because it makes me so angry. Uh-huh. It's my biggest pet peeve, and I will yell at the TV.
So really what they should be saying is, has been demonstrated to support our theory that it...
Hypothesis. Yes. Yeah. So the second thing that I wanted people to know about science is that scientists speak in very, like, hedging language. So and even as I say this, I'm doing it, very rarely will a scientist make a broad sweeping claim. So you'll hear scientists say that there's, you know, a situation that could potentially be deleterious in the future. And what that means is we're all going to die. So scientists tend to speak very conservatively about their estimates, about their claims, because we rely on statistics and error to tell us how likely something is to be close to the truth. Because you can never gain access to the entire, you know, say, population of animals that you're interested in looking at. You can never gain access to every single instance of a chemical reaction that will ever take place in this particular way. There's just no way for you to do that. You have to do something a certain number of times and see how many times it works the way that you think it should work, and then analyze that to see how close that is to random.
So Dr. Deep, who was in the book Deep Trouble, I think makes exactly this point when the little sister character says, oh, there's no such thing as mermaids, or there's no such thing as sea monsters, and Dr. Deep says, scientists wouldn't say that, scientists would just say, no one's discovered one.
Exactly. 100%. We could say we have no evidence for sea monsters, and if you present me with evidence of a sea monster, I'll be super excited. But yes, as of right now, we have no evidence for mermaids.
There's obviously also been this sort of big campaign to discredit science by saying, oh, but it's just hypothesis, it's just theory, misusing the term theory, as I did earlier.
Right.
And also, like, you know, nothing's proven, et cetera. So how would you respond to that?
Yeah, and that's something that we encounter all the time. And it's entirely an issue of communication. scientists are using the same words to mean different things as happen in, like, lay communication. And so it's really, really important that scientists, when communicating with the general public, speak differently than we do to each other. And science communicators also have to speak differently. And that actually brings me to my third point.
Excellent.
Which is that in public-facing articles, like in newspapers or in magazines, science communicators typically do a very poor job of relaying what scientific papers say. Mm. And one of my very favorite Twitters is @justsaysinmice. Where I think he's a biostatistician, finds articles where the headline claims something like,
chocolate cures cancer.
Exactly. Yeah. But it was only done in mice, and then just says in mice in his retweet in all caps.
Man, that's such a good public service that account provides.
Oh, yeah. It's so good. And so he calls it micing. But yeah, so people get really, really excited about things that aren't necessarily at the point where we can get excited about them yet, because people are expecting a very all-or-nothing communication from scientists who work with data and black and white numbers. But the reality is so much more nuanced, and we don't do a good job of communication.
Yeah, for sure. Or educating people in scientific literacy, right?
Right. We definitely need to do a better job in science education with our youth. There's just so many different ways of thinking about things. So, like, I really love listening to podcasts where, like, literature scholars will go through and do, like, close readings of things, because it, like, keeps that part of my brain active where I realize that, like, not everything has this, like, one correct analysis, but, like, with, say, like, chemistry, there is one right answer for the problem that I'm asking my students to do, and they need to do it correctly, or they won't get the right answer. And where do these electrons come from?
It is possible to be wrong, just not 100% sure you're right.
Exactly. You, like, there's
I feel like that's the philosophy I live my life by.
It's really important that you use that terminology because the words that you say inform the way that you think about things, and it's really important to think about things in a way that hedges your language, because you need to be careful about what you say, because the things that you say have power.
That was so well put. So this is one of my favorite and most irritating things in all of Goosebumps, which is the mad science that we get. We've talked a lot about this on the podcast, right? We have Dr. Brewer creating plant-human hybrids. We have Dr. Tucker studying swamp deer, Todd making a worm house, Dr. Merkin turning dogs into human children. Is there one of these people who you think is the best scientist? And, like, is there one that's the worst? What are your thoughts about science in the Gooseverse? And also, is any of this actually worth pursuing scientifically?
Yeah, I mean, I think we can all agree that Todd, who is an actual child and has not been trained in science, is probably the worst scientist, because gathering worms and putting them into a container is not science.
Damn.
It does not actually, like, he does not have a hypothesis. He isn't, like, changing anything about, like, the worm's environment except, like, bringing them out of the ground and putting them into, like, a smaller container. It's just not, he's collecting. He's not sciencing.
So observing things isn't science.
I mean, you can observe things, and that can be important, but it is not an experiment.
Ah, yes.
It is still, observational studies are still important, but it's not an experiment. I don't think Todd is even observing, though.
No, because he's not
looking at his worms. He's just acquiring them.
True.
So I would say that here Todd is the worst scientist. And so not having read these books for a number of years, I would love to go back and, like, dissect all of these things. But one issue is that we don't actually get any insight into the adult scientists' process, because the protagonists are children, and also R.L. Stine is not a scientist, so that's not what he chooses to focus on, which is fine. That's why I'm writing my zombie novel where the main character is a scientist. But I think the study that I'm most interested in, again, and is the plant-human hybrid one, and I do actually think that that's really important. I don't know how to achieve it. but one issue that we face as a society is getting human organs for transplant. Mm. So if you need a new kidney, a new liver, you have to wait for either someone to donate something of theirs or to die, and then you can get their discarded organ. And there are a number of companies that are pursuing trying to grow human organs in other animals, which has a number of ethical issues associated with it. If we could grow human organs just in dishes, that would be great. I would be extremely excited about that. Growing them on plants seems to be not feasible because plant tissue and human tissue is very different. However, certain plants grow very quickly, and if you could humanize plant tissue and make plants grow human organs that were like serotyped to a particular individual, you could have plentiful human organs.
Wow. Okay, that's the best answer we've gotten so far for why would he be making tomatoes with faces.
Mm-hmm. I think I did talk about that on Instagram. Said that on Insta.
That remains the best answer. So
no offense to the rest of y'all.
First of all, there is a comic book series called Farmhand that this is the premise. This guy is growing plants that have these different organs popping off of them, and it's really fucked up. He kind of made a deal with the devil, and it's really good.
That sounds wonderful.
But yeah, I am curious about Dr. Brewer's process and also his experience of university lab culture. First of all, the way that he made his plant-human hybrid was some of his blood got onto a slide that had plant molecules, and the plant molecules mixed with the blood molecules, and that hybridized them. So question one, is there a universe where that could happen? Well, I guess that's the wrong way of phrasing it.
Presumably there is a universe.
Yeah.
In the multiverse.
In this universe, I have never seen that happen. The mechanics of that bewilder me. So
that's not the approach.
That is not the approach I would take. The approach that I would take would be to go to the library, because there's a lot that you'd need to work on that topic. First off, seeing if there have been any examples of plants being grafted with non-plants.
Mm.
So plants tend to take grafts very well, but I think the big issue would be the survival of the human tissue,
mm-hmm.
because animal tissues do not graft very well. And so what would you have to do to the human tissue to get it to graft?
I mean, this sounds like a great science fiction novel waiting to happen. What would you have to do to it?
Plead. Bargain.
I mean, you'd also want, not necessarily just want to make grafts, but you'd want the, like, plant to spontaneously, like, grow these organs. And there's just a lot that has to happen. And I'm not super sure where to start, except by going to the library.
Yeah.
Like Hermione.
Excellent plug for libraries.
Mm-hmm. Mm, yes. Yeah, it also would raise some ethical questions about which things you should and shouldn't grow off of a plant. Like, can you get a replacement head?
Yeah, I think there's a lot that... Should we be doing this? Let's just see if we can.
I just feel like you wouldn't grow a whole head by itself, right? You'd have to grow the component parts and assemble them at a certain point. Or...
A head is very complicated, and there's a lot of different tissues that make up a head. I don't even know where you'd start making a brain, because a lot has to happen to get the brain to develop in the correct fashion.
We, the three of us, tried to make a Jell-O in a brain mold, and even that was complicated. So
it was complicated.
We were just impatient as part of it.
Okay, we've talked about a lot of paranormal, science fiction-seeming things in the Gooseverse, but we are wondering if any of them might have an actual scientific explanation. So we've come across ghouls who explode in the sunlight. Dogs can sense ghosts and bark at them. There's cameras that can harm people. There's time travel, giant worms, werewolves, any of these things. Dogs that get turned into children through hormone injections.
We can probably put this on Instagram or something. So this is an artist's rendering of a giant prehistoric worm.
Oh God.
It's got mandibles.
Yeah.
With razor-sharp teeth.
I don't even know which part of the worm I'm looking at.
The face.
Yeah.
I mean, I could look closer. I don't want to.
Yeah, no, that's fine. So,
it's kind of cute.
This article actually came out yesterday, or at least on National Geographic. It came out yesterday. They reported finding these giant tubes where prehistoric worms used to live, and they were about 6 feet long, and the worms would live in the mud and then come out of the tubes and grab a fish and then go back in and eat it.
Oh, cool.
We are very used to the, like, terrifying Space Australia animals that we have today, like kangaroos that will punch you in the face, and bears in general, like hippopotamuses. Like, we do have a number of, like, science fiction horror animals just, like, hanging out on our planet, and we're just used to them, so we don't think about them as science fiction horrors, when in actuality they're terrifying, and what are they doing here? Emus.
I love how conspiratorial they sound. So it's just now, it's like, emus.
Yeah.
Think about it.
They won a war against Australia.
I'm scared of emus. My friend's dad had an emu farm.
Oh, they're terrifying. Yeah. There's an emu and ostrich farm just north of Santa Barbara, and you can go there and feed them, and they will attack you for the food.
Yeah.
They're terrifying.
Pay for that experience?
You do pay for that experience. It's wonderful. I would go back in a heartbeat. Yeah. They're terrifying. But, yeah, so we're very used to the, like, scary animals that we have now, and we don't think about them as monstrous. We think about historic, like, prehistoric animals as being particularly monstrous, but there used to be a number of giant terrifying worms that would just, like, come up out of the depths and eat things.
That's cool.
Yeah. If you look at it the right way, anything on this planet can be horror.
This is part one of our goose science chat, but there's more to come. We will be continuing our conversation with Sam about goose-verse science. Thank you for coming on.
You're very welcome.
To be continued.